Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze. On today's episode, I'm here with Benton Brown and Peter Dixon. How are you guys doing?
Good, good.
You guys got some big beards. I'm not sure I'm, got a big enough beard to be able to hang out with you here in this booth.
Well, winter's coming, you know.
You got no razors up there in Vermont? Is that what's going on? Well, we're glad to have you here. As many of you listeners know, Peter Dixon's something of a living legend in the cheese community. He's made cheese since the early 80s and consulted for many artisan cheesemakers and dairy farmers around the country for almost 20 years. He's now the owner and head cheesemaker at his very own creamery in Westminster West, Vermont, Parish Hill Creamery, along with his wife, Rachel, who's here in the booth with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Nice to see you. And his sister-in-law, Alex. Benton Brown's experience in cheese is a bit more recent, but he's already been a visionary in bridging the gap between the rural nature of cheesemaking and urban consumption by developing cheese aging facilities in these old lagering tunnels right here in Brooklyn in Crown Heights. Currently, he's aging many of Peter's cheeses for the New York market, and he's got some more salacious activities going on in some of the other cheese caves, which we'll get into later. How are you doing, Benton?
We may need a whole other episode for what's happening in those other tunnels.
Flavored body oils, things of that nature.
Definitely.
Well, it's great to have both of you here, and we'll get to some harder-hitting questions in a bit. But first, I wanted to ask you guys real simply, why cheese, and how did you get into this business? Peter, I'd love to start with you.
I got into the business because my family had a dairy farm in Guilford, Vermont, and I was just kind of bumming around in the early 80s. Playing music, rock and roll.
A lot of cheesemakers, yeah. And a lot of cheesemongers are musicians, I've found.
Well, I grew up in the country, and I tired of the urban life. I don't think I'd make it down here.
Why is that?
Too many people.
Everybody from here is moving up to Vermont, so they're coming for you.
I still got my woods that I know I can take
barrier.
A walk in, yeah.
So you said your family owned a dairy farm?
Yeah, and of course, even back then in the 80s, it was evident that if you wanted to milk a small herd of cows to make a living, you would have to add value. You couldn't just sell that milk wholesale to the processor. You had to become your own processor. And so we jumped into the cheese business out of a business bottling raw milk, and that was 1983. And I was home for Christmas, my brother as well, who is a student at the University of Vermont studying animal science. My brother Sam has been the herd manager, dairy farm manager up at Shelburne Farms for the past 20 years. So we were both home for Christmas, and my parents proposed this idea of segueing into a cheese business.
Sure.
And starting a family business together, and that's how I got into it.
That's the roots of you.
Roots of me and him.
That's great, and I mean a lot of the people that I've interviewed that are from the dairy background have that same story. You know, they got to add value to the milk, and it seems simple and obvious after you've answered the question, but people don't understand, I think, how much value that it adds.
Oh yeah, it can make it 10 times as valuable.
And then now after a long time, you have your own creamery.
Yes.
At Parish Hill Creamery. How did that come about?
Well, that is something that I've always aspired to be operating. Always in the back of my head, I want to be making my own cheese. I had a great run at Consider Bardwell Farm.
Yeah,
from,
absolutely.
2007 till 2012, where I developed several cheeses for them and helped them grow to produce quite a bit more cheese and achieve their goals. And you know, my time to segue into my business came about two summers ago, and we started working on it, Rachel and I, getting our infrastructure together and ideas about what cheeses we should make. And I've created a passion for Italian style cheeses really in the last decade, and I wanted to stick with that because they are a very intriguing. They have a broad spectrum. You know, you can make anything Italian style. Could be very hard, long age, down to something that's just, you know, softer. And all can be made from raw milk. So that appealed to me to stick with that. And I just felt like, marketing-wise, there isn't enough of that cheese being made in small batches in a real traditional manner.
Well, as a guy who works for an Italian company, you know, I'm a cheesemaker, a cheesemonger for Italy, I definitely understand what you're talking about. I've been a cheesemonger for about as long, you know, as I can remember at this point. And I came to Italy a lot to learn about the styles of Italian cheesemaking, and I found out about pasta filata cheeses and how underrepresented they were in the American market. And one of the cheeses I know that you have at Parish Hill Creamery is called Suffolk Punch, which is very much like Caciocavallo. Or to me it is, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that recipe for a second.
Yeah, sure. That is something I started working on like 15 years ago. I started making the hard provolone-style cheese in that gourd shape, and was real popular, very easy to sell, and fun to make. You know, it's like the thing I like about cheese making more than anything is it's an art form, and I like to make the different shapes, and then the thing that Benton's focused on, the affinage, is super critical because that's where you can create these different hues on your rinds and textures, and that's the art form of it. So actually being able to hand sculpt a piece of hot curd into a shape like that is still every day when I go to the cheese room, you know, we make that cheese about two, maybe sometimes three times a week. It's exciting. It's fun.
Yeah, it is. My guys pull mozzarella for me every day. And, you know, you get these kids, and at the beginning, you know, I have had kids who never had any cheese experience whatsoever, but they love to play with the curd. Uh-huh. And on Benton, you have a special relationship with the curd as well. Your caves take Peter's cheeses from Vermont and finish them there. And I was wondering if you could tell us about the effect of the aging caves that you have on cheeses like the Suffolk Punch.
Mm, mm-hmm. Well, also back to the make of the Suffolk Punch, all that stretching, it is also a tremendous amount of work.
Oh, yeah.
It is fun, but it will give you a
Well, you've been up there and done it, right?
I have done
he
it
has
once.
Had his hands in the curd.
That's the best feeling
yeah.
ever.
I have
it's
my
vaguely
my
pornographic feeling sure. to put your hands down in that vat. Rachel, would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And everyone has heard their signature
experience.
Their signature gourd that you can tell
by
they
the
made
top.
It by the top.
By the shape
so.
Of the
yeah,
top.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. So The Suffolk Punch is a cheese that is a pasta filata cheese, which means you know, stretched curd, roughly in Italian. But talk about that. So the tops are, if you ever see a guy make mozzarella or a gal make mozzarella, they sort of pop the top off like it was the head of a Barbie doll that they were destroying, or a G.I. Joe, or a dandelion, or something like that. And then but the top, at the top, there's a little button of cheese. And with the Parish Hill Creamery, you can tell who made the cheese by what the top looks like. So I was wondering if you could tell us what that's all about.
We call that the knob, actually.
The knob. That's
the knob.
Not pornographic at all, either.
Not at all.
Oh, hell no.
And we sometimes refer to it as the salty knob.
Oh, yeah. This is a good show. This is a good show.
It's a very good show. Yeah.
I feel like I should be totally drunk.
You have to. You have
show.
To have me back because I
absolutely yeah,
okay. The salty knob. Salty knob.
Peter
show.
Salty knob yeah. Dixon
I make
is welcome
the saltiest
to the booth
knob
anytime. You make the saltiest knob of all.
Actually,
fantastic.
Mine is more like a spire.
Excellent.
He has more of a tip. He has more of a tip on his knob.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then we have the Preston.
Our younger listeners. Jack's going to have to break out the slide whistle, I think, to get rid of some of these descriptions. But that's all right. That's all right.
And the apprentices do different knobs as well. Yeah. I know one, Sam Frankie, likes to do little small knobs. He thinks that's more of a traditional.
And we have Vito's style is more of a mushroom cap. big,
that's really
wide
cool.
one. Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. And I actually agree with you. And Benton, I know you come from an art background, so I know that your interest in the cheese is art on some level because we've discussed it. And I agree with you. And I'm forever a man that is not fighting against science, but I'm a terrible scientist. I've been in and around the cheesemaking process so many times I can't count, and I've taught so many classes and tastings on cheese, I always mess it up. But the beauty of it and the ability to make something like that and to create those objects and put your own stamp on them, to me, is what is so so relevant and wonderful about cheese. And it's the window through which I see those products. Maybe you agree with me a little bit on that.
I do, but to get there, to get to that point where you can actually create that wonderful art form, there is that science of fermentation.
It's there.
And what I've chosen to do, and Rachel's been on board with me about this for our Parish Hill Creamery, is to go back again to the traditions. Because we're making real traditional Italian cheeses, I felt that we had to make our own starter cultures to ferment that wonderful raw milk that we get from the Elm Lee Farm in Putney, Vermont, that's part of the Putney School. And so what we did was we went and talked with the herd manager, the farmer, about what are his favorite cows, his healthiest cows, really, is what it comes down to. And he chose three Jerseys and three Holsteins. We went up with one of our apprentices. She had previously been a student at the school and worked in the summer as a milker. So she hand-milked six of these cows, one after the other, into a nice clean bucket. We poured each cow's milk through a filter and collected it in a mason jar that had been sterilized. And then the caps got put on the mason jars. We brought those home and let them sour naturally in the creamery. And from those, we have made four native starter cultures that we make all of our cheese from. So those are the agents that ferment the sugars in the milk to make the curd that then we can assemble and develop into the wonderful products that you are appreciating.
Absolutely. And that bath, that sort of that ferment bath that it goes through is a very Italian, it's a very Italian process.
You know,
an older cheesemaking process that a lot of people don't start the milk like that anymore. They purchase cultures, correct?
Exactly.
And even farmstead operations using milk of their own herd don't really do that very often.
It's very rare, and I'm encouraging people to do
this.
Why,
though? What's the advantage?
People are talking a lot about terroir, locality. Well, what better way to bring that into your cheese to get to market and deliver that to the consumers than to use your milk to make your starter cultures?
And you can taste the effects?
Certainly.
For airheads like me that don't understand.
Well, you have seven basic bacteria that we can choose from to ferment the sugars in milk, to make lactic acid, to get the primary fermentation going. But we have several, up to 100, I don't know, many, many more bacteria in milk that are desirable to
for
flavor development type fermentations. And we get all those. We don't really know what's in that starter.
Sure.
We know that it performs well because we can measure the pH development and know that acid's being made. But then we need to wait during the aging process, which is what's going on in Benton's Crown Finish Caves, to appreciate these new flavors, or we could call them old flavors, flavors that are more traditional coming
through
the
cheeses. That's really what it is, right?
Yeah.
So they're no new old flavors. And so Benton takes these cheeses from the salty knob and he brings them down underground to his dungeon down there in Crown Heights. And what have you got going on? I actually wanted to ask you about the affinage process, because a lot of people now have cheese caves in their stores and things of that nature, but that's not what you're doing. So what are you doing, and how does that add value to the cheese?
Well, what we're doing is we're taking cheese that's 2 weeks max in age, you would say.
Yes.
And, some is as young as 5 days, all raw milk cheeses that we take and we give them the full treatment. We are able to spend a lot more time with the cheese than sometimes at farms they are unable to give it the attention they need. And you know, also Peter and Rachel are keeping half batches, so we were able to do side by side tastings and compare affinage techniques and what we're doing. And that's really what we're doing down there, is we're giving the care that's needed to bring the cheese to its perfect ripeness. And, you know, we're doing the best we can on that and tasting things as we go and getting things figured out as we go and trying different, a lot of R&D is happening down there. And, but to separate us from what's happening in the retail shops, you know, I'm open to, you know, what people have to say about that. I mean, we're taking large quantities of raw milk cheese and aging, and that's all we do. We're not a retail shop. So, That's one big difference. A lot of retail shops are just, you know, doing the final touches on cheeses and
they're just giving them a nice house to live in.
It's an important
they cut them up and sell them. Holding. And you're bringing them along and developing the flavors. I mean, I just I get it.
I mean, I'm sitting, you know, I'll be sitting for up to 2 years on some cheese.
That's fantastic.
You know, and that's maybe a little different than what's happening at the retailers.
I'd like to add in that I was just down there this morning for the first time to see our cheese aging down there. And, you know, I've been doing this in Vermont for years and years in various sundry spaces. But this is a real wonderful cheese cave that he has constructed down there. It is like walking into a bygone era, except for the fine air handling equipment.
Yeah,
you
it's
could
really
be in a very old space. It's an arch ceiling. It's brick. It's solid, you know, rock under the street. It's wonderful, and this is what's special. What's special about it? I'm envious.
Well, that I mean, and in the aging facilities I've been in, I've often seen in old spaces turned anew. When I was in the fortress of Saint Antoine in the Jura, we were like 30-50 meters down below in this old repurposed World War I fortress. Talked with Jason Hines about that on an earlier episode, you know, and I also was in been in the caves in Luigi Gufanti where they took an old prosciutto cellar and, you know, and refined the air quality and done that. And I've been in Benton cellars as well, and they're really amazing. I find it fascinating that there is that it's so clean and perfect down there. But it's the city and city and country dirt to a country boy like me are very different. I mean, I ate a lot of country dirt, for better or worse, but like city dirt, I want to wash off my hands, right? Oh. Right away. You know what I mean? I'm always afraid of it, but
I mean, one thing is it's a super controlled environment, and that's something that's kind of hard to find, and that sort of takes a lot of the mystery out. Sometimes this cheese is really fucking great. But we had a fluctuation in temperature in this month, and it changed here, and maybe that created this to start happening. And so it's at least taking one piece of mystery out of an equation in the aging process. You have a super stable environment, and you can base your decisions on things you actually do to the cheese and maybe not the fluctuation of your environment.
Yeah. See, the other thing, too, that's going on is I've been harping on tradition, and, you know, this is, I hope, to be my last cheese business. So making our own starter cultures, getting our salt from a small company in Maine that solar evaporates Gulf of Maine salt water. That's
right.
Our salt going into our cheese.
I know those guys.
Yeah. And, you know, this raw milk as the basis for the cheese, and then pairing up with Crown Finish Caves that's doing a traditional thing. Taking green young cheese from the country where it's made and aging it where the market is. That's what I think is so special about what's our collaboration.
It's fascinating. And because you come from a very rural area, Crown Heights is decidedly not that. So,
and being in sort of the urban environment, you know, that's what one thing that separates us out a little different is chefs can come, people can come, we can select out individual wheels that they want or well, certain batches.
Yeah, people,
you know,
can look for a flavor profile. That's one of the best things about aging facilities is that you get to work with people who are looking for specific ages and textures, and you can help them through science to get to exactly where they want. But I wanted to ask Rachel, do you hope this is the last your last cheese business as well?
This is the last.
Is the last.
It will be the
business.
Last, I guess.
Yes, this is the one.
That's what I figured you'd say. Well, we're going to have to take a tiny break, but we're going to come right back and talk a little bit more with Peter and Rachel and Benton about some other things.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Cutting the Curd. On last week's episode, I spoke to Aunt Saxelby about how many folks are understandably up in arms about regulations affecting the artisan cheese community in the U.S. It just seems like it's that kind of time right now. And these policies also affect consumer access to cheeses from around the world that are produced to certain standards. Peter and Benton and Rachel, I wanted to ask you your thoughts about these issues and variants. And more importantly, what are you doing and what do you think of our listeners should do to affect change in current policies?
Wow, that's a very good question. We could spend the rest of the day talking about
that. I got a lot of time.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have focused quite a bit on regulatory issues during my career, just because it's interesting to me, the food safety aspect of making cheese, you know, making a safe food. It doesn't have to be cheese, but the criteria are pretty much the same, no matter what you're making. And so having had a focus on that, I've received a lot of training in hazard analysis and critical control point, which is kind of a proactive, or it is essentially a proactive way of approaching making a clean and safe product to deliver to the market. And I still feel that that's the, no matter how you want to call it, whether it's hazard analysis and critical control point or risk reduction practices or whatever, that this is the way to go. And I think going forward, it would be nice if part of our regulatory system in terms of getting a license to actually manufacture cheese commercially would include a certain number of hours of training in that realm.
It doesn't currently.
No. And we're a country that doesn't require that. We're surrounded by countries that do, Canada, European countries. And I think it would up the level of knowledge throughout the land amongst the people making cheese, and we would have less sort of issues and tugs of war with regulatory. It would be a lot more collaborative if we would put that in. Now, what they, I think, should put in from their side...
Who is they?
The regulators, mm-hmm. The people that actually police us, would be more training on their side in terms of what is cheese, how do you make it, what are the different varieties, how are they made. Quite often we are approached by people from regulatory that, for example, an FDA official might come to do an inspection having no prior knowledge of cheese. He's out of seafood in Boston, for example, and now he needs to learn about cheese. So, you know, training on both sides before the actual enterprises start, I think, would be very helpful.
anybody that's been in food service knows that you're going to come up against BOH people that don't know a lot. My father was a Board of Health official for 30 years, and some of the people he worked best with were people that he had personal relationships with, and I always feel that interpersonal relationships are best. So you can teach people if you go about it the right way and you talk to them the right way. If you deal with inspectors, I always feel like if you can break down the us versus them mentality in general, you're doing better than if you don't. But I find it interesting, your initial point, that we don't require those hours to be put in for that licensing, and we're surrounded by countries that do, yet we're one of the largest consumers of dairy products in the world. So how, guys, would we go about – how would you go about, Rachel, getting that done?
Right now, the ACS, the American Cheese Society, is doing great work working directly with the FDA.
That I know. I was at the conference this year, and the FDA spoke.
And I feel like that we're moving in the right direction by sitting at the table together and talking about, you know, really being upfront about the concerns of the regulators in terms of making sure that producers are producing safe products, but also with them listening to the cheesemakers and to the cheese industry professionals about what their concerns are, being open to looking at traditional methods and what has worked for hundreds of years.
Do you feel that's going to get done, just on a personal
level?
I'm
hoping.
Got to have hope, right?
I'm hoping. Sure. I mean, I feel like we've seen there's positive movement in that direction, so I'm hoping that it will continue. There have been a couple of blips in the past year, couple of years of things, miscommunication, shall we say, and difficulty understanding exactly what each side.
Well, the beginnings of any real relationship, first few dates are always kind of rough. You know what I mean? You got to get to know.
Yeah. Getting to know each other.
Another. So you feel each other out, you know?
The other point that I wanted to make is just that safe food, I mean, everybody wants to make safe food.
Absolutely.
But one of the things that you have, that if you want to make quality food,
yes,
it's a lot of the same things.
Well, of course it is.
So bearing that in mind, instead of feeling, trying to understand that the very things that we do to make safe food are also going to help us make the highest quality.
Yeah, they go hand in hand. I mean, they're part of each other. I mean, in terms of what can we do to be ready? I mean, there's a great fear of this sort of unknown with the FDA. You know, they have rules, they have laws in place. Do they enforce them? All of a sudden, they start to. You could have a big problem, and you could be running a very clean facility. And so, for me, you know, keeping up with lab work and keeping a good paper trail of what we're doing and how things are clean is just building up sort of a notebook of protection in some way, just because there is an unknown. And that's just one thing that scares me a lot in what we're doing, you know, is clean.
The unpredictability.
The unpredictability of the higher powers that be that, you know, are somewhat out of your control.
But you live in that society on every level. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It's true.
I mean, you can be pulled off the street for no reason at all.
Yes.
And thrown behind bars. So, I mean, either you stay locked in your house and don't do anything, or you get your goddarn notes together and hope that, you know, you got your papers in order when they come in. And I think that's part of the reason why I'm a retailer, because I'm terrible at paperwork.
Don't require your papers. You know, it's not like these are the rules you need to follow them. It's sort of like make a clean product, keep a good record, but we're not going to require you to do that. But
right.
Another thing that people can do, I believe we're still in a comment period.
Absolutely.
The FDA is looking for comments. And so for producers to submit those comments and you can go to the ACS on their website. They've got information about this. But how is it going to affect you? How do changes in rules or proposed changes in rules, how will they affect you? And so really giving that some thought and getting your ducks in a row and being willing to give your feedback.
Communication is everything. I mean, in every business and all relationships, sometimes we work in places where, you know, the head and the tail don't don't talk to one another. But unfortunately, fortunately, they're all attached to the same body, so they got to work together. And one of the ways to communicate, what I've found, and I've been dragged into because I predate it a little bit, is social media as a tool of communication. And I follow both of you guys on social media and see some really interesting things coming out. Rachel, you do the social media for Parish Hill Creamery. I always see interesting experimental things going on up there, and recently you guys did a vertical tasting of another cheese that you guys make called the Humble Herdsman, and I was wondering if maybe you guys could talk to me about what the Humble Herdsman is and how your tasting went. You're laughing at me?
No. There was a lot of anticipation for that tasting, and it was definitely on the younger side of the tasting. I think we come away with...
So, just as an aside, for those of us who don't know, the Humble Herdsman is a cow's milk cheese.
Yeah, I'll describe it.
Please do.
It's the softest cheese we make. It's a simple tome. It's more of a French-style cheese. I think what I've learned, one of the traditional French practices is to wash a tome with hard cider.
Yes, and I've seen that.
Yeah, and so that's what we do.
Why do you do it?
Just because it intrigued me.
Yeah.
And I've done some of the experiments around that in the past and liked the results. So I figured, why not just create this cheese entirely that way?
When you say you like the results, like, did you like the results of flavor and texture and all of those things?
All of those things. I like the way the rind looks. It gets a little rumply from the growth of the yeast. It has these powerful enzymes that break down the proteins, and then you get the rumply texture developing as the interior begins to soften. And then I also like the mushroomy fungal nature of the taste. And I like the texture of the rind. It's got like a bread crust type of rind. And you combine that with the sweet milky flavors in a young cheese. And then we found in the tasting that the cheese that spent 2 months here in the city versus the cheese that spent 2 months in the country, they're fairly much the same now.
And that's the tasting I had mentioned.
Yeah, but given time, I would say a cheese like that will have some different experiences when you're tasting it. I don't know when that's going to happen because we're just doing it. We are using different ciders. We're using a cider that is made in Vermont, and down here Benton's using a cider
from Michigan, Virtue Cider. Red Streak.
And I saw you had a keg down there. I figured that was just for your personal consumption. You know what I mean? I was getting lonely down there working on all of your...
I mean, we go through a lot of it. Every other day, we're washing that cheese. I mean, we're really...
Turning and washing.
Yeah.
I mean, I like it, and it's all seriousness, I like cider washed cheeses, and I like cider. And in the parts of Europe I've been fortunate enough to travel to, northern France, especially in Normandy, Brittany, and even further in the Pas-de-Calais, there's a lot of cider and a lot of apples up there, and they wash a lot of cheeses in them. And when you mentioned the breadcrumb texture, one of my favorite cheeses that I had up there was a little camembert that was covered in breadcrumbs that had been soaked in cider.
Nice. Uh-huh.
Which is like an old traditional thing. And that's pretty cool.
I guess the other thing too, when you think about this northeastern region we live in, both our state, Vermont, and New York State, apples are big.
Yeah, that's the best fruit that comes from around here, in my opinion. So, that's the best heirloom fruit that comes from around
here.
And
what did people mostly drink 100 years ago?
Fermented cider.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's great. So, I mean, the root, and that goes back to, you know, all the way back around to some of your initial comments about wanting to be true to the terroir that you're from, and I think that's really cool. I'm an exiled New Englander. You know, I live down here. I'm a New Englander in name only now. I mean, I still love the Sox to the chagrin of most of the people I have to deal with around here, but I think it's great, and I know where you come from. Vermont is a beautiful place and a great agrarian spot.
We grew up not too far away from each other.
Yeah. Well, where are you from? Guilford? Yeah, I'm from Templeton, Massachusetts, which is about as big as this room. Had the one blinking school light, you know what I mean? Benton, where are you from?
I'm from Nashville.
Oh, nice.
A little bit of a different...
What's the cheese culture like down in Tennessee?
Good question. There is one wonderful cheese shop called the Bloomy Rind down there that really controls the market besides Whole Foods. And she's great, Kathleen Cotter. Maybe you've had her on the show. I don't know.
I met her at the ACS, actually.
Yeah, really nice.
Or someone from the Bloomy Rind. I think it was her, but it was later in the evening, so I don't know. Now, are you selling them cheese?
We have in the past, and we hope to continue. I like to support my hometown, of course.
Yeah, and well, we like to support you, so that brings me to another interesting question. So how do you get your cheese from place? Well, we know that Peter brings his cheese down to you, but where do we get your cheese? Do we have to like go through a manhole cover, get down into the cellars, or are you distributing it locally now?
It's starting to come out, but yeah, the Peter. We get our shipment every other week from Parish Hill, comes down on a pallet and totes, all wrapped up, and then they're starting. You know, last week, I guess, when we started to make some of the Brooklyn Age cheeses that are available, the Suffolk Punch and the Humble Herdsman, and it's usually me that will bring it to you at this point.
So you're your own distributor.
We're very small, getting things worked out, and it's either Susan, my wife, or me, or an unknown character with
I met your little one. I hope that you don't have her driving vehicles yet.
That's right. But soon we're going to have one of the cheesemakers from Parish Hill is going to come and start working for us. So you're going to see this guy around a lot. And so his name is Sam.
That's really great. Well, you know, we support your business at Eataly. We sell the Herdsman. We will hopefully be selling the Humble Herdsman.
Yeah.
We sell the Reverie and the Suffolk Punch and another pasta filata cheese, which we didn't get to talk about too much today, called Cashar.
Yes.
But I really I want to thank all y'all for coming down today to meet with me and to talk to me about cheese, Peter. It's great to talk to you, Benton.
Thank you.
And it's always great to talk to you too, and Rachel, and our silent partner who shall remain nameless, who may or may not have been in the booth with us.
I'll never tell.
Thanks so much for listening, and tune in next week to another episode of Cutting the Curd, live on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.